The United Nations General Assembly Special Session on Drug Policy meets this year in New York. Vonda, what is this thing we call by its acronym, UNGAS?
UNGAS is precisely what you introduce. It is the Special General Assembly on a particular topic, in this case, on the state of drug policy, drug use. It's a very major review at the United Nations when the Special Assembly meets, because it involves really all actors discussing and reviewing broadly what has been the state of effectiveness of global policies on the particular issue, in this case, drugs. In the way that the Special Assembly came about ahead of its time, 3 years before it was scheduled, is because there is a profound dissatisfaction in some parts of the world, primarily Latin America and Western Europe, with the effectiveness of counter-narcotics policy and a sense that they are doing more harm than good. But this view is not shared elsewhere. It's not shared in East Asia. It's not shared in Russia. It's not shared in the Middle East.
I want to ask you about the divergence of views here in a second. When was the last time such a meeting as this took place?
So the last session was in 1988. And at the time, it introduced a set of new policies that really codified and anchored some of the hardline policies on drugs. And there is now a belief that these policies are ineffective, or at least a belief on the part of some of the actors. And again, that they are more counterproductive. So the next session was supposed to be in 2019, but it's meeting 3 years ahead because several countries pushed for a review earlier. Now, there actually was another session in 2006 that also reviewed drug policy, but in no way was as sort of profound in anchoring certain policies in as the 1988 session.
Can you talk about what some of these disagreements that you've alluded to among nations on drug policy are?
Mm-hmm. So for the past 20-some years, 30 years, there was a set of essential hardline policies. Criminalize, certainly drug trafficking, focus on the disruption of drug markets, disruption of drug supply, seizing the shipments of drugs, as well as imprisoned users. Now, often there would not be a specific requirement to imprison users, but de facto, policy were translated into many non-violent drug users around the world being either sent to prison or sent, in the case of East Asia, to so-called treatment centers that, for all ostensible purposes, function like special prisons. So in the United States, for example, there has been tremendous growth in the prison population related to drug use and low-level drug dealing, as many addicts support their habit by dealing drugs. And this has a tremendously negative effect, particularly on African-American families, with large numbers of African-American males being in prison on drug charges, but also on the whole family life, and has greatly overburdened the U.S. justice system, correction system.
I was fascinated to learn from the research that you've led with Harold Chinkunas, who's also a senior fellow here at Brookings, on drug policy. You led a drug policy review with a lot of other experts, and there's some country-by-country documentation about how they treat, say, drug offenders, drug users, drug interdiction, these issues much differently. For example, China views drug use as a moral failure more than most other countries do.
Absolutely. And so this goes back to the issues of this deep schism that has developed in the international community and deep disagreement in the counter-narcotics regime. On the one hand, countries in Latin America have focused on the large rise in criminal violence and often linking it to the illegality of the drug trade. So Latin America is by far the world's most violent regions, with murder rates on the order of tens per 100,000. In the United States, the murder rate is between 3 and 5 per 100,000, with some important exceptions, such as Baltimore or Chicago, where it can also be in the tens per 100,000. In contrast, in East Asia, there is as much drug trafficking, drug production, and perhaps even more drug use than in Latin America. But violence levels are very, very low, 1, 2 per 100,000. And so the countries in Latin America are saying, look, we have done everything that the United States had wanted. We have pushed very aggressive eradication of drug crops, often with hugely destabilizing political effects, as the cultivators of coca and marijuana and poppy would rebel and would be alienated from the government. This often complicated our counterinsurgency efforts, such as in Peru or in Colombia. We've also experienced big rise in criminality, despite the fact that we have put tremendous amount of resources into disrupting drug supply heading to the United States. So they focus on the violence levels and say policies have failed to stem the violence and see as the foreign, almost imperial colonial experience, that of the United States pushing very hardline drug policies or having pushed. And I'll come back to the U.S. in a little bit. On the other hand, in East Asia, the violence levels are extremely low. Crime, violent crime in particular, is very low. And drug trafficking is extraordinarily peaceful. And so there is not the same impetus to push for drug policy reform because the harms to the state and society are not distributed equally. And their colonial, their imperial referent is that of the Opium Wars, where Britain and other countries were forcing them to accept opium, and which was producing large addiction rates, with China in the early part of the 20th century having very large rates. And so when we now engage with countries in East Asia, they say, well, drugs are moral failure, and the imperial Western element that's being forced on us, it's once again forcing opium or other drugs, for that matter, down our throat. So they are not interested in drug policy reform, and there are not constituencies for drug policy reform. And the Middle East is an increasingly fascinating new space with not only historic addiction in places like Iran and Turkey, but rising new addiction in places like Saudi Arabia, Jordan, as well as Iraq and Syria, with large traumatized populations and increasingly drug trafficking intermeshed with terrorism. And so they also are not interested in reform, even though they too have much to learn from policies that that don't work. And so the U.S. is here a very fascinating actor, because the U.S. really was the architect of the global counter-narcotics regime going back to the 60s, and arguably even prior to that. The first Shanghai treaties on opium, for example, in 1908, had very large U.S. involvement in them. And certainly since the 80s, the U.S. was the chief global policeman, the chief global enforcer of the regime, and often insisting on eradication of illicit crops, forced eradication as precondition for aid, often driving interdiction policies focused on as much disruption of supply and drug trafficking groups, as well as domestically pushing for very tough prison policies toward users, and having very little tolerance for any country deviating from the system. For example, when Switzerland started experimenting with heroin maintenance, U.S. was very much opposed to that. When the Netherlands developed the coffee shops for distributing or selling marijuana, United States very much opposed to that. But it's changed. The U.S. has learned from its mistakes. It has adopted different policies in places like Afghanistan. It has not insisted on poppy eradication there. And it is developing a better set of policies toward, for example, what's called harm reduction measures, such as distributing needles to addicts, so one mitigates the spread of infectious diseases. There is also a push from states to reduce prison population, certainly for nonviolent drug offenders, both because they do not stop using in prison, but also because that overburdens the prison system and state coffers and has tremendously negative effects on social fabric. And finally, and crucially, states in the United States are legalizing marijuana. And so the U.S. has stepped back from the role of being the chief policeman and insisting on one set of policies, very hardline policies, and now talks about embracing flexibility at the international level. Now, there are other important actors in the system that don't like the flexibility, that still embrace the hardline policies, and those are Russia and China.
Speaking of the United States, I want to quote from the policy brief that you co-wrote with Harold Trinkunas, and you wrote, as a result of changes in its domestic drug policies, the United States finds itself increasingly in a questionable position in terms of compliance with the international counter-narcotics regime and treaty interpretation it fostered.
And this goes precisely back to the issue of the marijuana legalization taking place at the state level. One of the big fundamental issues is whether this is consistent with the international treaties. And certainly 10 years ago, maybe even less than that, the United States would have said absolutely not. But since then, Uruguay has legalized the production of and sales of marijuana. And they claim that they are not in violation of the UN treaties. And the US, several US states have legalized, and more have legalization of marijuana on the ballot. The big case will be whether California legalizes this fall. But the United States is now saying, look, we need flexibility in interpretation of treaties. So because the United States does not want to be in lack of compliance, formal lack of compliance, whereas previously it was denying such a flexibility to countries such as Switzerland or the Netherlands.
Earlier you mentioned these deep schisms in the international community over some of these issues. You just brought up China and Russia. Can you talk about, heading into this special session, what are the bases for agreement for all these countries, if any?
Well, so the so-called zero draft of the resolution has been circulated. So that's the document that the international community, very broadly speaking, has accepted. And the document, I think, enables consensus because it speaks in often very large categories. And historically, the international community would maintain that there was a holistic approach to dealing with drugs, that this was not simply about criminalization of drugs, that it was equally important to focus on demand reduction and prevention, and that it was insufficient and inappropriate to simplify drugs with eradication, with suppression and interdiction, but that it was equally important to focus on alternative development, alternative livelihoods for farmers of drug crops. So these core elements are still in the zero draft document. And so if one sort of to compare the documents from 2006 and 1988, one might say, well, there are not so fundamental differences. However, they also sort of represent papering over the issue. Where I would say there has been progress is much more in the emphasis on some of the non-punitive element, non-punitive policy tools, which clearly was not the thrust of the previous document. However, the issue that the documents does not deal with is marijuana legalization okay? Is it, or any form of legalization okay? And this is where the big break comes in. So the current zero draft has better emphasis. It also situates drugs within the sustainable development goals. That's important and can be very positive. Can. It depends on what is actually implemented. But it really papers over the deep disagreement and in the international community and the reality, in my view, that countries will increasingly go their own way in drug policies, including, for example, further legalization of marijuana, that will nonetheless generate spillover effects for other members of the international community, and there will be pushback against the policies. So the treaty flexibility, the general language of the document, are papering over what I have called deep global dissensus on what drug policy should be about. And we are heading, in my view, toward increasingly not just fractured pluralism with respect to drug policies, but also contentious pluralism, because policies in one country, drug policies in one country, will affect developments, policies in another country. And so there is no flexibility. It's nice to some extent, but also it's difficult to sustain on the ground. So there will continue to be a lot of searching for policies. Now, the good thing, hopefully, out of this pluralism is that there will be greater opportunities to develop policies that match specific environments, where policy, instead of demanding that one approach fits all institutional and cultural settings, can hopefully be better tailored toward local settings, but also where countries will be able to learn from policy experimentation and adopt much better, much more humane, but also much more effective policy toward drug use, drug trafficking, than has been the case.
So what emerges from this special session, and how does that translate into national and even local policies?
Well, I think that the important thing that emerges for national local policy is, for the first time in decades, a sense that countries have greater latitude to experiment and adopt different policies. And that's been missing for decades. The sense was that there was only one way. But now that's changed. So there is more of a sense that policies can have local ownership and be better matched to local environments. Nonetheless, countries have very different view of what are appropriate policies. And because drugs are one of the issues that's global, where policy in one country generates spillovers of others, there will be a lot of disagreements about what the appropriate policies are. What happens in one country with respect to drugs does not stay in that country. And the new document, by introducing flexibility and by introducing greater variation in policies, necessary as that is, does not escape the problem of spillovers.
And then finally, in the United States context, what kinds of policy changes do you anticipate may come out of this, if any?
Well, I'm not sure that the United States will necessarily drive its policies by the result of UNGAS. I would say the opposite. The United States has tried to shape UNGAS to match its policies, including by now embracing treaty flexibility. But there are some strong forces in the U.S. on the ground, including the legalization of marijuana and how that shapes policies toward drug use, but also how that encourages or discourages other countries to experiment with their own policies. So I would say for the United States, more than the UN session, it is its own domestic policies that are driving global trends. But for many countries, the UN session is very important in giving them a sense of how much latitude they have toward experimentation or not. And again, I think there is much more of a learning, for example, that in order to combat HIV/AIDS, hepatitis, and other infectious diseases, throwing drug users into prisons, denying them medical care, denying harm reduction measures such as needle exchange are negative, that it hurts, not helps, public health issues. I think there are perhaps too exaggerated expectations of what alternative development can do. It's very important because so many policies toward drug supply have been so punitive and have really ignored the plight of very marginalized, very poor populations, which overwhelmingly are the majority of drug users. But nonetheless, alternative development takes decades of efforts, resources, and auspicious circumstances, and we will not see major reduction in drug supply in 3 years when the next UN session will meet. And I think that we need to really face also the fact that we are not very good at reducing demand, that drug prevention and demand reduction measures have often not worked, and we need to really smarten up about those. So for me, the biggest positive effect is that there is now possibility for experimenting with policies which will hopefully produce learning, which will hopefully produce evidence and encourage policies to go in a better direction than has often been the case.
Well, thank you for your time today, Vanda.
My pleasure.
You can follow Vanda's research on UNGAS and many other topics on our website at brookings.edu.